Hey, this is Sean Ramos-Firm. I'm the host of Vox's Daily News podcast, Today Explained. You know, since like late September, we have done probably close to a dozen shows on this impeachment inquiry, from the sort of early rumors of a whistleblower complaint to Nancy Pelosi launching the formal impeachment inquiry to the whistleblower complaint coming out and the so-called transcript coming out to the Republican counter-narrative to the White House stonewall. We've done it all. But it all felt like it was leading up to this moment of televised impeachment hearings. And the event of that event was the testimony of Gordon Sondland. And we wanted to make sure we made an episode that properly showcased and explained the significance, the historic significance of that testimony. And we did it. And we want you to hear it. It's available in our feeds right now. Today Explained, the episode is titled Impeachment TV, Mr. Sondland Goes to Washington. It's a must listen. I wouldn't say so if it weren't. Go check it out and enjoy it. Thanks.
A pod of their own. This is episode 32. I am Allison McCaig, and I am joined this week once again by my lovely co-hosts, both of them this time, Linda Serovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
Yay, we're reunited again, and it's been a minute since we've been in your feeds, but we're in the slow part of the off season now, so actually not much has happened for once. Our premonition about off season recording has finally come true, at least when it comes to the Mets, I feel like, because the Mets are just kind of chilling, rolling right along. They have hired their coaching staff, so it's kind of the major positions are filled now. So Chili Davis has returned as hitting coach, and they have hired two new coaches. They have hired Hensley Mullins as their bench coach and Jeremy Hefner as their pitching coach. So do you guys have takes on either of those two hires?
I mean, it's kind of weird because it seems like they did something smart. And like from what I've been reading, these have been both really good hires. Even when everything I read about Hefner when he was with the Twins, it looked like he was very heavily into analytics, and he just seemed to like hit the ground running with them. So, I mean, when I heard that he was one of the finalists for the position, I was like, please, 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 please. And they did something right. So I'm actually pretty pleased. And by all accounts, what was Hensley Mullins? Is that it?
Yeah, Mullins.
How do you pronounce
his
name? Mullins. By all accounts, he's been really good with the Giants and probably is long overdue to have a coaching position. But so, and has the connection to Beltran, too. I think they both have a connection to Beltran, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was Beltran's hitting coach.
Yes. So giving Beltran support is actually good, since we saw the opposite happen with Mickey Callaway when he first got hired. So it seems like they're trending in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think in terms of like, in terms of kind of risk level, I do feel like this is a high risk group in general, because they went for three first timers for the position, I believe. And that's an interesting call, but I would take it over what they tend to do, which are go with people who have previously failed, because why always with the failure? I don't, it just seems like a risk, but a different kind of risk, and one that has potentially a lot more upside than like another guy who has lost three jobs before, you know? And I do, I am actually really happy also to see that Phil Regan is staying on the staff. and like not in quite as high profile a role, but I thought he really clicked with the pitching staff. I think he'll be a really good mentor for Hefner in a lot of ways. Like, I think that's a really positive dynamic, and I'm glad that they're keeping it.
Why always with the failure, the New York Mets story? But yeah, no, I agree with both of you. I think that, you know, it's certainly risky to have to support Beltran, all these guys who, you know, are pretty new at this. I mean, Mullins was the bench coach toward the end with his tenure with the Giants, I believe. Like, he was the hitting coach most of the time.
Yeah.
And then I think toward the end, he was the bench coach for like a year or two.
Yes,
maybe?
I think he was.
So he has been a bench coach before briefly. But I do like that they're surrounding Beltran with guys that I think play up his best assets. I'll say that. Guys like Mullins who, you know, speak five languages and seem to really be like a player's coach, which I think is the way like Beltran's going to manage. We know Marcus Stroman already was extremely impressed with him. Marcus Stroman tweeted that about that today, or was it yesterday? I think it was today.
No, it was today. Yeah.
Yeah. Stroman tweeted about how he sat down with Beltran and he was super blown away by his knowledge of the game and he can't wait to play for him. And so that's the type of stuff you want to see. So that's pretty exciting. And yeah, and Jeremy Hefner, you know, not too far removed from being a player, just like Carlos Beltran. And so, you know, I feel like they're the type of coaching staff that are going to be like a player's coaching staff, so to speak. So we'll see how that goes. You know, I think that the trope that Beltran needed a veteran to guide him was a bit overdone, even if there was some substance to it. But like we said in a previous pod, like, what the heck did Jim Riggleman ever do to help anything?
So, right. What's true. With all the failure?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, this is a fresh change that I like to see. And hopefully, you know, it turns out on more of the positive end, more like the forward thinking end that we like to see when we hear of more fresh hires and we're not talking about, oh, they're inexperienced by, you know, mid-May or whatever. But
and
yeah.
Stroman also defended Beltran against the cheating too.
He did.
Yeah. So it seems like Stroh was fully on board.
Yeah.
So can we just extend him?
I know, right? Like, Stroman bought in from like day one. Remember when like there were like 30 seconds there when people were like, he didn't want to be traded to the Mets, he wanted to be traded to the Yankees instead. And ever since then, he's been like fully bought in to the Mets. I don't agree with his stance on the black uniforms, and I do not want to talk about the black uniforms on this podcast because we've already gotten too many arguments.
I think we should talk about the black uniforms because it's that kind of off-season.
We can talk about it, but my point about Stroman is that even though I disagree with his stance about the black uniforms, it's another example of him, you know, fully embracing the Mets, which I like.
The culture of the good side of the culture with the Mets. I don't want to be like embracing all the Mets culture. That is a dangerous
fully embracing the Mets culture is bad.
But like actually. But he's the bought into the player. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like he's proud to be a Met. And you know, that's not something we've had recently. Like usually it's, oh God, shame, shame, shame. I can't put this uniform. Like not that a player said it, but like, you know, you kind of thought twice wearing your jersey out in public.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's somebody that makes you proud to be a fan again.
Exactly. And Linda, I think you've talked about that in the past with this on this podcast. And it's just nice to have players who like being Mets. It's like as simple as that. It's fun to have players who like being Mets.
Big Pete's another one.
Yeah.
He just seems like genuinely happy to be here, specifically here.
Yep.
And that's pretty nice. I'll take it.
It's refreshing.
That's something you like to see. And I think that, you know, these coaching staff hires only kind of like highlight that in a way. So that's good. I hope that all of this works out. I desperately want them to succeed as a unit under Beltran because, you know, I want nothing but good things in life for Carlos Beltran. So I'm hoping that it's not another instance of like of kind of like what happened right after the Beltran hire, which is like the Mets did something smart. Oh no, he was instantly implicated in a cheating scandal right after that.
That was peak like, Mets. That was the Metsiest thing I've ever witnessed in my life.
So like, now even when they do something right, like it has to Mets always.
Yeah, now yep. I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop on these two seemingly good hires.
And it was also the same week, like they made the good Beltran hire, they got a rookie of the year, and they got a Cy Young. And then immediately it was like,
Nope, Mets fans, you're not allowed to be happy for more than 5 minutes. That's the rules.
Wah, wah.
But yeah, it is slightly confusing that they like seem to be going this direction, but then they're like, all right, Chili Davis, you can stay. That's kind of weird.
I'm not thrilled with the Chili Davis retention. That was not what I was hoping for. But not I also know that like in the land of overrated roles, the hitting coach is king of them all.
Yeah.
How do you have Wilson Ramos hitting so many ground balls? I just don't understand it.
Retaining Chili Davis for his star pupil, Wilson Ramos.
Yeah, right?
Oh, and also the argument's like, well, look at what he did with, like, Pete and Jeff. No, they're just good.
They're just good at baseball, man.
And I was like, oh, like, look at the season Jeff McNeil had. Like, look what the season he had last season was. It was the same season. That's why I like him.
Yeah. And it's like only like, I don't know. It's like the Mets are like, oh, we've hired these dudes who are like analytics forward. And then we've kept this guy who thinks that hitting ground balls is the solution when the balls are juiced. Cool.
Maggie, I think you made the good point that like the one person who seemed to benefit was Dominic Smith.
Yeah.
And then the other one is Ahmed Rosario, who are two hitters that kind of don't really fit the more classic modern mold and are probably going to suffer from being crammed into it. But like, you don't need to make him the hitting coach for the whole team just for them.
And yeah. Who knows what Dom's future is here.
I was going to say, unless Dominic Smith is traded for Starling Marte.
Which
brings us to our next topic of discussion. Really, the only other Mets news besides the hiring of the coaching staff is that the Mets appear to be interested in a trade for Starling Marte.
Which they absolutely should be. I mean,
yeah, sure.
Sure.
He's a good baseball player.
Don't think it's going to happen, but sure.
Is his defense really that good, though?
Defensive metrics differ.
Like, I get he might be better than, you know, what they have now, because what they have now are not real center fielders, and he is actually one. But is it worth it for maybe an upgrade defensively? I don't know.
He's a good hitter, though. And I mean, it would be an upgrade just like overall to the whole picture of your outfield depth, for sure, because the Mets right now have like no outfield depth whatsoever.
There's always Cespedes.
Yeah. There's always
Cespedes. There isn't.
We can dream. We can dream.
I mean, it does, like, if they do this trade for Starling Marte and Cespedes comes back, then it becomes awfully crowded. But that's kind of a, like, that'll be a good problem if it happens sort of thing.
Yes, indeed. That is, like, the absolute best kind of problem to have.
True.
This is a Linda-specific trigger warning, so cover your ears, Linda.
I know. I need to, like, take my
That's a trade
now.
J.D. Davis mid-season situation. yeah. I mean, Starling Marte is almost guaranteed to provide value beyond his salary.
How many years does he have left?
He has
two.
Well, one in an option.
I think one is an option, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So
the 2 years of control,
and they are, you know, cheap given his production most recently in his career. But the price to get him will not be cheap, and the Mets have already somewhat emptied their farm system. So do they really need to be continuing to do that. Who knows? It really depends on the price. You know, I could see, you know, their pre-arbitration players, i.e. Smith and or Davis, being part of this trade. But the problem with especially JD Davis in that scenario is that you're kind of trading outfield depth to get outfield depth, and you're just prioritizing that this one can play center field. I mean, he is a better fit for the roster, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I guess I still...
He's a good baseball player.
I'm just still not 100% convinced that Nimmo can't stick there for a couple seasons. Like, I just... The talk about, like, oh, it's not like you can put Cespedes in center. You know, Michael Conforto is bad in center. Nimmo is on the roster. And, like, I totally, obviously, no question, they need to do better than Lagares for a backup. But, like, it seems like the widespread expectation is that they must get a starting center fielder, and I just don't see it.
Yes, I'm with you. Like, spend on the bullpen, spend on a starting pitcher.
Should have spent on the starting catcher, but yes. Oh well.
Yeah.
Or a backup catcher. Like, on the list of issues, I think you can survive a very good hitting outfield.
I would take most of last season's lineup as is and just put all the money into pitching and bench players. Like,
yep.
The starting, if you got your starting outfield of McNeil, Nimmo, Conforto, and then you've got Alonso, Cano, Rosario, Davis. I mean, that's a perfectly cromulent lineup. Like, that could be a very good lineup.
And we saw that when they were firing on all cylinders, they could beat anybody.
Yeah, and I think the problem is you get, like, injuries, and then you're playing, like, freaking Aaron Altair out there, and they need to not do that. They need to, like, I don't know what it takes. They just need to be in a position where they're not doing that. And then the pitching. And, like, and that's, I mean, I feel like those are big things, but certainly not bigger than all those things, plus also a starting outfielder, because you just don't want Nimmo out there, I guess. I don't, it seems kind of odd to me that it's just taken as, like, axiomatic that the Mets have to get a center fielder.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like, I don't disagree with the idea of this trade on principle. Like, on paper, yeah, it's fine to me.
I like Marte.
Like, Marte is a good player. It's fine to me on paper. And, like, most of the proposed, like, packages that have been thrown out there, like, are things that I would give up for Starling Marte because he's a good baseball player. On paper, it's fine. I am worried about what it implies for the Mets, what the Mets think their priorities are. I think that it indicates that they have bought into this narrative that the starting center fielder is the most important hole on the roster, and they can therefore just kind of, after, if they do this trade, they can kind of be like, oh, well, we took care of the most important thing, fans. Are you happy now? And not do the other stuff, when the pitching is the more important thing and they should be prioritizing that. Now, if they trade for Starling Marte and fill all their pitching needs, then great. That's awesome. I just worry that that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like Marte doesn't feel like a depth building move, because I feel like you're going to have to move someone out that would have been there anyway. And that, to me, is not optimal.
And again, this is a cover your ears, Linda. I'm afraid it's Brandon Nimmo that will get benched instead of JD Davis. And I would rather, and it's not that I don't want JD Davis to get at bats. I think JD Davis should get 300, 400 at bats, but you can get him that without everyday left fielder JD Davis. You can get him that in, you know, combination left field, third base starts, you know, twice, 2 to 3 times a week, while also getting him plentiful pinch hitting appearances in key spots, which is, I think, the best role for him. I fear his exposure every day, left fielder JD Davis. And I think that Starling Marte in center field with Brandon Nimmo and Michael Conforto at the corners is the better alignment. And also, Starling Marte has hit righties better in his career. So it's actually kind of a weird, like, pairing. So that makes me think that it's Nimmo that gets benched, which I don't like.
No.
Do not want to bench Nimmo.
No, he proved when he came back, when he's healthy, he was back to being Nimmo. Like the on-base percentage shot way up. You know, he was still getting the power came back. So, you know, he kind of needed a neck to be able to bat in the beginning of the year.
Who knew?
When you don't have a neck, it's not a good situation.
To be able to, you know, turn and swing and hit the ball. I don't know. I just don't trust. I mean, this is also the Mets' pattern. They never know what they have until it's too late. We saw it with Murphy when they got rid of him or let him go. We saw it with McNeil, how it took them forever to call him up. So, you know, until they prove otherwise, they might not know what they have in Nimmo.
Yeah, I think the Mets still don't think Brandon Nimmo is good, which is an unfortunate thing.
I mean, they won't play him in center field, which is... Like, again, I know he's not a great center fielder, but also, like, Starling Marte is not a, like, gold glove center fielder either. I mean, he might have a couple. I can't remember if he has any. But, like,
he's
basically a scratch center fielder and was actually, like, pretty below average this year, though it's, I mean, 1 year of fielding stats is kind of wonky. But, like, it's... I don't know. It just seems to me that he's not that, like, Nimmo is not that much of a downgrade defensively from any of the options that are easily available to them. So I don't know why. Again, it just comes back to, like, what do they have against Nimmo?
I don't know.
Whose wife did he, like, take out one night? I don't know.
It's confusing. It's confusing, but...
Or what their plan is. Like, why are you focusing on this? Can you maybe re-sign Wheeler?
That'd be great, right?
That would be what I would be focusing. Even bringing back Darno would have been fine.
Oh, boy. He's gonna beat the crap out of the Mets now. Everyone knows.
Revenge tour.
Yep. But whatever.
What's Mesoraco going to?
It's fine.
In the meantime, we will cover all things Mets in future episodes of the pod. But for now, we are going to take a break. And when we get back, we are going to bring a guest that we've already had on the pod back on the pod. So get excited. Dr. Meredith Wills is back, and she is going to talk to us about the postseason baseballs and the latest development in the are the baseballs juiced, are they not, what's going on developments. So stay tuned for that.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back, everyone. We have a very special guest this week. She's been on the pod before. Welcome her back. Dr. Meredith Wills, astrophysicist, baseball contents extraordinaire, knitting expert, baseball Hall of Famer, you name it, she's it. She's back on the podcast to talk about the postseason baseballs this time. So hi, Meredith. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing great. So the baseball, the story of the juiced / de-juiced / who knows what baseball just keeps on getting, the plot thickens ever thicker as we go.
But as thick as the baseball cords.
Ooh.
We may never know. We may never know.
Yeah.
Plot thickens as the laces do.
Well, I still need to find out if the game ball laces have thickened, but we will
find out. Yeah. So just to set the scene for those of you who may not have been following this as closely as all of us nerds.
Rob, for those of you who are hidden under a rock during the postseason.
For real. So everyone, pretty much everyone around baseball noticed with, you know, their eyeballs that the ball kind of appeared to be de-juiced again during the postseason. And Rob Arthur of Baseball Prospectus did some fantastic work on the actual data to show that it appeared to be that way, that it was trending in that direction. And then he later noted that there were vast inconsistencies in average daily air resistance during the postseason. And in fact, it was one of the largest ranges in individual aerodynamic performance in the last 5 years. So this kind of runs counter to claims from Major League Baseball and Rawlings that they've improved the manufacturing process. And Manfred keeps insisting that the postseason ball is coming from the same batch as the regular season ball, and that the only difference was that they put a postseason stamp on it. But the variability kind of contradicts that claim. So Dr. Wills did one of her studies into the postseason balls and found, you know, even more than she probably had bargained for. So Meredith, can you tell our listeners about what you found?
Okay, yeah, this one, I guess it's a great setup. I remember when I guess I should start by saying that this became a weird enough thing where after a while, the science part almost took like a backseat to the, you know, it almost felt like solving, like literally solving a mystery in a detective kind of sense. You know, it's like, yeah, here I'm sleuthing about the postseason ball. And
are you like breaking into factories with a baseball cap and dark sunglasses?
If I could get a ticket to Costa Rica, I might actually try that. Although my Spanish isn't nearly as good as it used to be. So maybe my dad would help. And, you know, he's a baseball guy and his Spanish is really good. So he and I will discuss that afterwards.
This is becoming more and more a TV show I want to watch. So,
oh yes, God, I'm quite honestly like waiting to see how the book / movie ends at this point. You think I'm kidding? So what happened was, we had this insanely aerodynamic ball and broke all of these home run records, and then the ball, starting in the postseason, at first it looked like it kind of fell off a cliff. And then it was kind of hard to tell game to game. You know, and some of it, I think, does come down to people seeing almost what they want to see. Because I remember having conversations with people where they'd be like, yeah, that would have been a home run in the regular season. And, you know, if you actually looked at the numbers, like, well, actually, no, usually a ball that went out at that launch angle and at that exit velocity, 75% of the time was just to fly out. So it's like, yeah, you know, it looks cool, but actually, no, excuse me, the other way around. That would have been a fly out home run. You see where I'm going?
Yes. Yes.
The point being that like people were seeing almost what they wanted to see to a certain extent. So it really took Rob Arthur doing that work. And his first work was, which I think is why everybody was so convinced at pure dejuicing, was he was doing these week by week averages. And MLB came out with their lovely statement saying all of the balls for the postseason are taken from regular season lots and that it's just the postseason stamp. One thing, by the way, that's sort of an interesting caveat is if you go back and you listen to, I think it was an interview he did in 2017 when the Astros, we can talk about the other Astro stuff later, but anyway, you know, remember the Astros won the World Series in 2017.
Oh, yeah, those guys.
Those guys, yeah. And there was a discussion at the time where they thought that the postseason ball might have been juiced. And once again, Manfred said, it's interesting, it's an almost verbatim, you know, yeah, we took the postseason balls from regular season lots. It's like, okay, we've heard this before, didn't realize that. So I guess that must just kind of be a standard. This is how we approach this question. But so, as you say, Rob then went back and looked ignore the crashing in the background. My cats have just knocked over something big. I will check after we finish talking. It's all right. I knew they were going to do this.
The perils of owning cats.
Yes, yes. Particularly when they discover a few days earlier they can jump 5 feet vertically. Always good. Anyway,
the best.
It wasn't as bad as it could have been. But yeah, so I guess long story short, we find that they found the ball was, or Rob, I should say, found the ball was all over the place as far as drag. And so obviously got to look at more baseballs because, you know, what else do I do with my life except knit and do cool analytic stuff and look at baseballs.
Oh my God. And have trying to convince us you're not a superhero. It's not working.
I'm a superhero too, but that's a whole nother story. You again, you think I'm kidding. I'm not. goes back to the astro stuff, but astrophysics, not the Astros. Sorry. to specify. Sorry. I've never worked with the Houston Astros.
This is a very Meredith problem, I will just say.
It is.
Fixing up the astrophysics and the Astros is like not something everyone has to deal with.
Yeah.
So fixing astrophysics might be easier than fixing the Astros right now.
Boy, howdy.
That one's somebody else's problem.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, but so I, decided, okay, great. I'm going to see what's changed about the ball because clearly something had changed. It was pretty clear from the data that the issue was the drag. I mean, even the Cardinals, and I love that it says a lot that the front office for the Cardinals let Mike Schilt come out and say, our analytics group found this about the drag being higher. And it was like, 4.5 feet on average, the ball was traveling.
Yeah, I think
4.5 feet less. But it is a lot. And in fact, it's if you compare it to the kind of numbers that even for the home run committee report in 2017, what they were seeing as like the change that led to, that 2017 home run surge back when that was a really big deal. Like at the very high end, what they were seeing were increases of 5 feet. And that was like their extreme. So if the average that the Cardinals were seeing was 4.5 feet, that said a lot. As far as I can tell, for the difference between the postseason ball and the regular season.
Yeah.
And again, the very fact that their front office said, yeah, here, sure, bring this up in a press conference. That's not usually crossover you run into a lot.
Yeah, because teams want to protect their data that only they have.
Exactly. And it was, them drawing attention to it, I think, This was important to the front office. This was important to the teams. This was important to the players because I think what I've been calling it to a certain extent is this was the unpredictable.
Yeah.
Sorry. I do the pun thing occasionally. It happens. But so, yeah, so it was obviously getting postseason balls is not easy anyway because it's a short period of time and because everybody, if you're going to have postseason balls, nobody wants to like donate their foul balls or, even batting practice ones tend to be just regular season, all that kind of stuff. So it's, hard to track down any kind of postseason balls to begin with. But, I have ways and same kind of ways that I got unused game balls, literally from during the regular season where, it's the way that you do this stuff. I mean, journalists, same kind of thing. You have sources. And so I went to the people who I knew would be able to help and ran into a lot of roadblocks that after a while seemed kind of preternaturally unreasonable.
Yeah.
Such that I literally had, in some cases, people where, sent me pictures of, oh yeah, here are these unused game balls from the postseason that I have that I can get to. And then I would hear back later and say, well, actually I can't because if I do, I'm afraid it's going to affect my employment status.
Ooh.
And it was like, and it sounds like hyperbole, except that by the end of the process, I can't go into a ton of detail, but yeah, that did basically happen. So they were completely justified in their paranoia, I guess, is my point. So I don't fault anybody for not doing this, but it did mean that getting, you know, the balls from people who had access to stuff that was going on the field just really was no longer an option. And I did, you know, contact Major League Baseball directly about, you know, doing the study. When I originally talked to them, I just didn't hear back. I did talk to them later, after I'd gone through everything, but, you know, I guess that we'll leave that to the appropriate point in the story. So what ended up happening? Oh, I mean, like I said, it's not just the standard, you know, scientific investigation. It turned out to be very strange. So what I did was, you know, I said, okay, bite the bullet. And I went and I bought balls directly from Rawlings. And I went to an awful lot of trouble to make sure that these were exactly the same balls that were being used on the field during the games. And it was everything from, you know, they've got their website that's got stuff, you know, that along things that would basically say, yeah, this is the official postseason game ball. This is the ball that's being used in all of the postseason games. Same thing for the World Series. The usage specifications on their websites said Major League, comma, game, as opposed to a bunch of other kinds that said Major League, comma, memorabilia. So, like, this is a game ball. I, you know, double checked actually calling, you know, there's a little customer service phone number. And so I wanted to make sure that this was all what they said it was. And so I called customer service and, you know, talked to the guy, and he went to his supervisor, who then made a phone call to come back and say, yeah, you know, these really are the balls that are being used during the games on the field. And then they show up and every single thing says official game ball, and they have authentication stickers on them. They even, you know, they came in like little boxes, basically. It was like, it was almost like they were designed for resale. And in fact, if you see picture, if you've been in the major league parks at all, and certainly I even got someone to like look into this stuff at one of the postseason games at Nats Park. I mean, one of the World Series games, I guess. You know, these were literally being sold in the team stores, and they had authentication stickers on them, you know, and again, the same packaging of the, you know, this says official game ball. And there was sort of nothing there that said, okay, you know, clearly these are balls that are being used on the field. There was really no other way to interpret that. And so I should say they're not, you know, what I paid for them was probably half of the price of what they were being paid for in the parks, and that was not cheap. So, yeah, you know, that's another good reason to think, okay, these probably are balls that are going on the field. But I then went through and actually found a bunch of stuff that was that seemed to be consistent with what Rob's data were showing, in that of the 36 balls that I had, 2/3 of them were clearly not manufactured for the 2019 season. And this is where I could go back, and I had, you know, we're talking about the thicker laces thing, for instance. The laces were thicker from like the second half of 2015 through the end of 2018. You know, and then for this season, they got thin again. You know, so hence fewer pitcher blisters. But the balls that I looked at for 2/3 of, I had 36 baseballs. And so 24 of them, one had thicker laces. They're consistent with, you know, sort of that, call it the home run surge one ball, basically the 2017 home run surge ball. And then of the other ones I had, even though they were clearly 2019 baseballs, you know, like they fit all of those criteria. What was interesting there was that, they still, 7 of the 12 I got wouldn't have actually met quality control standards for game balls.
That's not a good sign.
Well, it's a weird thing because it has to do with the way that Rawlings, and I should say, in terms of me determining that these are the quality control standards, this is based on all of the research that I've done. It's not like I've been to Rawlings and they've confirmed this particular thing. Mm-hmm. They confirmed a lot, but not this one in particular, which is that after the baseballs are made, they go through and they put the stamp on, and occasionally they stamp the wrong side of the baseball. The ball gets stamped upside down. And it turns out that it's like really easy to spot because if the ball is stamped upside down, the stitches go in the wrong direction.
Oh, yes. The V.
Right. The V is literally in it's, you know, I have counterclockwise versus clockwise. If you look at the Athletic article that I have, this great picture showing the comparison. And the ball itself could be game quality, like it could be as good as the ones going on the field, but just for whatever reason, quality control, if the laces are, you know, if they see the V in the wrong direction, they automatically throw it out and say, this is something that'll be sold to the public, not something that'll be used in a game. So 7 of the 12 from this one batch that was clearly 2019 didn't meet game quality control. And then of the other 2/3 I had, none of them were made in 2019. So it's like, okay, of 36 balls, I have 5 here that I am confident would have been regular season 2019 game balls, which didn't really seem like the case. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe what we're dealing with is that the reason the drag was down in the postseason, drag was up in the postseason, was because they were using baseballs from previous seasons. I mean, that would make a lot of sense, right? You know, because the whole point is that the ball's not carrying as far, and we've just gotten out of a season where the ball carried further than it ever has in history. It's a good way to do it. But on top of it, it also looked like, okay, maybe the quality control standards had been relaxed for whatever reason. You know, and again, not that they wouldn't have been game quality, but just they decided, okay, the stamping thing isn't a big deal anymore. So having come to these conclusions, I contact MLB for a comment saying, you know, by the way, this seems to be what's happened in that there are sort of the standards that were used for the postseason are apparently very different from the regular season. And by the way, you're also using old baseballs. Which would explain everything that's going on. And rather than doing the standard, you know, you guys know how it is. You email whoever for comment for an article, right? This is just how it goes. Yes. And so I emailed for comment, and instead of getting the standard either no response or the nice, polite email back, I actually got an email from Pat Courtney, who's the chief communications officer with the commissioner's office, saying, actually, can we do a phone call? And he wanted to bring in Morgan Sword, who's the senior vice president of league economics and operations, I think. It's an impressive title. I don't remember the whole thing. and they wanted to do a phone call. And so I was, okay, you know, not what I expected, but we did a phone call. And all of it's on the record. And so it was like, you know, it was important to me to make sure that we could actually talk about like real stuff. And so I told them about all my results. And what they told me is they said, you know, first of all, that this whole balls that were from previous seasons wouldn't have made sense because they had assurance from Rawlings, and they were very, very specific about this, that all of the balls used in the postseason were made during the first quarter of 2019. So that whole idea of old baseballs didn't make sense. And then they also assured me that any of the baseballs that I would have looked at would not have actually been game balls. They would have been what they referred to as memorabilia balls. And it didn't sort of matter how much detail I went into about, you know, I should also point out that the balls I bought all had authentication stickers.
Yeah,
that's actually kind of important. They literally had authentication stickers.
Right.
it's not the same kind that you get, like, if you catch a foul ball and then you get someone to put a sticker on it, like, that I caught this pitch at this game or whatever. But it's comparable to, say, like, the authentication sticker you get on the hat that you buy at the park.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, people never, I will admit, I find it a little silly that people leave, like, the hologram picture or hologram sticker on the brim. It's
yeah,
like,
some people are really anal about that.
Yeah, and it's just like, guys, it's just a hat. You know, whatever. I admit
it's not in mint condition if it has your brow sweat on it.
Right, right. And, you know, I mean, even in my case, you know, because of where they put the authentication stickers on the cellophane wrap on the outside, I might point out. So I de-authenticated all of my balls instantly because, of course, I had to actually look at them. I kept all the information. You know, I have all the stickers. I have all the codes. But I, you know, like, it's almost like, oh, yeah, it's only authentic as long as you don't actually ever open it, it seems how right. That seems to be set up, which is yeah, a little bit, I guess I don't like that policy. It's like, yeah. You should at least be able to look at your own baseball. Come on. But so again, they insisted that these balls couldn't possibly be game balls. They had to be these memorabilia balls, and ended up putting me in touch with the chief operating officer at Rawlings, Dennis Solberger, who, you know, I got in touch with him and I told him all about the conversation that I just had with Pat Courtney and Morgan Sword, and how, you know, they were saying these couldn't be game balls, and that, you know, just sort of because frankly, I was expecting him to say, oh, you know, no, actually, they've got this backwards, particularly because everything I found fits so well with Rob Arthur's data. You know, it's like, it makes a lot more sense, actually, if you guys were taking baseballs from previous seasons and just using them as postseason game balls.
Right.
Because that's just like, you know, that's a much better explanation for the data than the, oh, yeah, there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that this could be happening type thing, which I'm sure got only worse as the postseason went on. I haven't checked the final odds with Rob. But I got a very, you know, thorough email back from Solberger. And he it basically said two things. One, he said that yes, they absolutely will take balls from previous seasons and put whatever stamp on them that they keep what they call blanks in case they run out. And that I think the way he put it was that the balls that I bought were strictly what he would have called commercial balls, and that they would never, ever have been on field. Like, by definition, if they were in those packages, they would not have been, had the possibility of being game balls. And I guess that's kind of the key thing is that, you know, I thought what I was buying, it's like, if you took it out of the box, you could in theory have used it in a game, you know, hence game ball, and all the stuff. And so that was kind of like, okay, we have two things. One, that means that all the data that I just gathered don't tell me anything about what really happened on the field in the postseason. And wow, Rawlings has just said that they're, you know, marketing and authenticating stuff as game balls that apparently were never intended to be game balls. And I kind of went, okay. At which point I got in touch with people who were not scientists and said, guys, can we find a way to look into this where people who know more about this kind of stuff than I can do it. And so Katie Strang ended up writing this great kind of joint article with The Athletic, where she then looked into what the implications were for, say, you know, Rawlings going through and representing these balls in at least a half a dozen different ways as game balls, you know, unused game balls, and that not being the case. And, you know, mostly what I was left with was, okay, I got a study to finish, and the worst possible source for me to go to is the actual baseball manufacturer. A little disturbing.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's like those... Have you guys ever heard those, like, I think it's Santander Bank, the commercials where it's like, your bank sent you on a wild goose chase? So it's
it's a little bit weird to be like, okay, yeah, your least possible reliable source for game balls is the company that actually makes the game balls. So I mean, yeah, the upshot for me is that anybody listening, I'd love to get my hands on some postseason game balls. Because
do it for science.
Get Meredith baseball.
If you can donate your body to science, you can donate a baseball to science.
Well, these baseballs are in fact giving their bodies to science.
That's true.
Yes.
Quite literally, they are. In
fact, let them fulfill their destinies.
Yes. I think actually one of you guys might have even been in on this back and forth where I recently described my apartment as being a charnel house of murdered baseballs.
Oh, yes.
That was one of my favorite Twitter threads of the week.
It's just fun, yeah. But although what I will say is that part of the reason it's important, I think, for me to keep doing this is because while the Rawlings COO told me, okay, you know, yeah, 2018 balls showing up is entirely reasonable, which I can't imagine people who are actually buying the balls would be happy with, because like they're charging, like they were charging on the concourse at Nats Park, like, you know, $40-$50 for one of these. And so it's like, all right, you know, says it's a game ball, it's not a game ball. Says it's 2019 postseason. Whether or not a 2018 ball would be part of the 2019 postseason, you know, that also kind of like, essentially, how authentic is this really? Despite the authentication. And so from that point of view, I can say, okay, this is probably an issue. However, Katie Strang, she talked to the chief marketing officer, Mike Thompson, it sounds right. And what he said was that the Solberger talked specifically to the memorabilia balls or these commercial balls, whereas what Thompson said was that they did the same, you know, having balls from previous seasons specifically in the context of saving them for balls to be used on the field. So he, in his statement to Katie, said that they basically do the same thing for game balls. So the idea, in fact, that 2018 balls, I mean, the hypothesis is still entirely reasonable, because Rawlings said, oh, yeah, by the way, of course we would use balls from previous seasons. That's just part of our standard practice. So that's partly why I really want to get the game balls, is because they could still be 2018. It's just I need them to be game balls instead of commercial balls.
And this all goes back to the simple fact that there are only two scenarios here when it comes to Major League Baseball, that they are either lying or they have no idea what their manufacturer is doing. And either one of those things is bad.
Yeah. Let's not overlook
the possibility both.
Okay. There is a third possibility. You've got MLB potentially lying or not, you know, or not knowing about the manufacturer. You could also have Rawlings lying to MLB.
Yeah, that's also
cool. Yeah,
you know, that's not unreasonable. It's still disheartening, but it's not unreasonable.
Someone's being shady.
Still makes baseball look bad, since they own Rawlings or are part owners in Rawlings. You would think they would know what they are doing.
Well, not only that, but you know, they. What I will say, and again, it was more just my own interactions, but, you know, Courtney and Sword were very, very, you know, very adamant about the idea that these had to be memorabilia balls. And so there was, you know, that was a huge focus of the conversation. And then when they talked to Katie, the statement that they gave her was that they're only involved in production related to the balls that are used on the field, which is, you know, I can understand that. And that might explain, because I believe they're a minority owner. So, but they also wanted to be heavily involved in the process. And so that's a good way for somebody who's, say, only a minority owner to say, okay, well, we're only dealing with a minority of production. Although, quite honestly, what you have to realize is all the baseballs are made exactly in the same way. It's not like anybody starts out making a baseball and says, yeah, you know, this is going to turn out to be a commercial ball. They're right. all intending to make them as game balls. It's just if they're not quite up to snuff, they're not game balls. Like, it's just that the standards are very high, and so not all of them become game balls. But, you know, the manufacturing process is the same, which everybody will insist on over and over. And I agree, the manufacturing process is the same. It's not, that's not the issue. It's, you know, and they all do meet specifications. I promise, you know, actually, that's not true. More than you think don't, but that's really only happened in the last couple years. But, you know, it is what it is.
A lot of things are happening in the last couple of years in baseball land.
Yeah.
You could say that. But, yes, so the there's also, you know, stuff that came out in the statement to Katie Strang saying that you know, when she approached the commissioner's office for a statement, what they said was, yeah, we're only involved on the manufacturing side as far as for oversight in terms of the on-field stuff. Which again presents a problem when they told me that, you know, they had been assured by Rawlings that all these were made in the first quarter of 2019. And yet Rawlings comes out and says, oh yeah, no, we're perfectly happy to do on field balls from previous seasons. And the implication being that, you know, if I end up getting balls from the postseason and finding out that they weren't made in the first quarter of 2019, I'm not really sure where that puts Rawlings and MLB.
Yes.
So it's it's awkward. It's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And I really, really don't want to be in, like, part of me would want to be a fly on the wall for those telecons, and part of me really, really doesn't.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I mean, ultimately, regardless of anybody's intentions here, and regardless of whether people are being wholly truthful or not, and it could be that everybody's being truthful and everybody has good intentions, no matter what, the ultimate result of this is that the sort of faith that the fans have in the integrity of the game is diminished in a certain way, because they're and the teams.
I was going to say, it's not just the fans. It's the players, it's the coaches, it's the managers, it's the front offices.
Well,
I don't mean the owners.
You have all of these, you have all these systems that are based on the premise that if you hit a baseball a certain way, it's going to act the same way between one season to the next. Like, for example, salary arbitration.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've got this entire class of players who tend to be very good and young, whose salaries are entirely dependent on how their performance is measured. And when that performance is being shifted by, for example, a baseball, like, mm-hmm. that just really, that's a problem. That's a big old problem.
On the other side, too, I saw in a quote from an anonymous GM saying, I don't know how to build a team next year. And I think we saw that with the Twins. Like, they, broke the record for most home runs in a single season and then couldn't do anything in the postseason.
Yeah. I haven't gone through and looked. I mean, it's actually something, again, I almost feel like, you know, I really just do this stuff to, like, tout Rob Arthur's work or verify it. You know, that's really it. I'm just here to show that Rob is you know, doing good research and all that. It's like, yeah, so secretly this is all just about Rob.
Rob,
don't tell him, by the way. Oh no, he's the best. But I do have to wonder if because the Twins were swept. Now granted, they were swept by the Yankees, who also were clearly a very home run heavy team, but the teams that ended up coming out in the World Series were the teams that had the strongest starting rotations.
Yes.
So you did end up filtering out the home run teams, you know, the ones that had how would I put it, I feel like the Twins, and this is not to discount what they did at all, because it was amazing, and I'm so psyched that they did everything they did with this season. But it feels like they built a team that would already have been good, but then they happened to get lucky in that because the regular season ball flew so far, they went from being really good to being insanely outstanding.
Yeah.
Because the ball happened to, you know, it was just like randomly they played the right roulette number and it just worked out where, oh, look, suddenly we can break all of these records because we'd already built a team that was going to hit a lot of home runs and now everybody's hitting a lot of home runs. So we'll just hit that many more.
Yeah.
But then by the same token, they got swept in the postseason. And I don't know how much of that would have been, would have happened or not had the ball stayed the same. And I mean, obviously there aren't many situations where you can look at, you know, if we'd had the regular season ball, would it have made a difference? There's one or two. I mean, my favorite, and by the way, I should preface by saying, go Nats. I'm really psyched they won. I'm so psyched they won. I mean, my best friend is a huge, huge Nats fan. And so like he's, you know, family's got season tickets, all the stuff. So like, yeah, he just had a blast. But the one that keeps coming to mind is game 5 of the division series.
Yep.
Dodgers, Nats, bottom of the ninth. Will Smith gets up and he hits what looks like a no-doubter and everybody in the stadium goes crazy. And the pitcher looks like, oh my God, I just killed all our chances in the postseason. And the Dodgers are leaping the dugout fence and it ends up in Andy Meaton's glove.
Yep. Yeah, I remember that one.
Right. And I think that's... Right. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, I think Rob in his article even said he factored in weather. So it wasn't like it was. And also that was in, I think that was in LA. So weather shouldn't have been affecting carry that much.
Well, I mean, the way that I look at it and I feel like this comes up in a lot of actually all the studies I've done, really, or certainly all of them where I've known what to look for ahead of time is I feel like starting with the players, and in that case, like the reaction, that stadium would not have, I mean, every single fan freaked out. The actual Dodgers players were jumping out of the dugout to celebrate. There is no way that anybody would have, like, I mean, you don't have however many tens of thousands of people instantly decide this is going to be a home run. And, you know, when it isn't like, not quite as many people would have risen to their feet. You know, the Dodgers wouldn't have jumped out of the dugout. It looked like a home run off bat if we'd had the regular season ball. I don't really think there's any question of that.
Right.
Because the reaction wouldn't have been the same. I mean, and you see that with players all the time where it's like they'll, you know, it wasn't like it was going to be a foul ball or something. You know, they know, they can see it.
Well, we saw that the opposite during the regular season, like people going, oh man, like they seemed so mad they missed it. And then it ended up 5 rows back.
Todd Frazier did that like 5 different times during
that. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Is Todd Frazier.
Yeah, Todd Frazier hit more home runs from his knee this season than I think anybody's ever done in baseball history. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Such a beautiful swing over there. So great.
What I love is that all of the post game interviews were, I meant to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. I mean, because he did a couple times and that was sort of the reaction. But I meant to do that.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's making the point being it's making the difference in postseason games and postseason series. It's making the difference between a World Series champion and not. And that's
right.
A big deal regardless of what team you root for. And it's hard to have faith in the game when this, like, I think about all the time how, like, Deflategate was such a huge scandal.
I was just gonna bring that up.
Such a huge scandal, and I feel like the reaction to this, obviously it's different because Deflategate was like a player and a team kind of doing it versus this is like we still don't really know the intent, but like Deflategate was huge, and I feel like the reaction to this has not been proportionate to the problem.
And also, I don't know if Dr. Wills, you could probably correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems there's no standard like there is with a football. Like, their specifications are so, like, the weight and everything. So how come there is no equivalent to a baseball?
Well, I mean, I apologize in advance if some of the stuff that I say sounds like I'm paraphrasing Manfred, but that's only because what he says isn't always wrong. It's just the way that it's just the context is important. I mean, what's cool, and it's one of the things I love about baseball is that, you know, with the exception, and I've checked this, with the exception of cricket balls that are made at like the very, very highest level, it's the only sport in the world where the balls are handmade.
Oh.
Everything else is some kind of machine, whatever. And even the balls themselves are wound on winding machines. So the interior is, you know, like there is a human being involved and it is yarn. So there's, you know, and it's good yarn, but it's not like the kind of thing you go and you buy at some, you know, insert high end yarn store here. So things like the thickness and the density varies a little bit. But beyond that, you know, they are stitched together by hand because, to this day, they still haven't managed to create technology that can do it economically or more economically than paying people to do it. And they even still skive, basically smooth out the leather by hand. So it is a handmade product with a handmade process. And that means you get a certain level of ball-to-ball variation. The 2019 balls had far less variation than anything. And spoiler alert, I've been looking into that. There will be more coming out, but probably not for a little while because, you know, we've got postseason balls to talk about. But beyond that, yeah, they do tend to just stick to these broader specifications. And Rawling's internal specs are actually much more rigid. And once you've deconstructed enough balls, you can kind of tell what they are. You know, it's like this particular layer gets wound until it hits a certain weight. Then they do the next layer of yarn. It gets wound until it hits a certain weight. Then they do the next layer. And so you can kind of reverse engineer their specs once you've, you know, sort of done this enough. But even within that, the kind of changes that we've seen have been, you know, they do what they call process improvements all the time. This is something that you know, certainly during the regular season, it kind of got glossed over in the, because they'd say, yeah, within specifications, or they'd say, what was it? No meaningful changes to manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And meaningful was, I feel like it was the big word because
doing a lot of work in that sentence.
Well, it goes back to this idea. And again, great. There's a great little table in the home run committee report from last year that shows this, which is they do these process improvements all the time. And they're related to things like the smoothing of the leather or the drying of the baseballs, which turned out to be like the really big deal thing for 2019. It was because they decided they were going to start, you know, taking a blow dryer to them instead to dry them. And that ended up changing the aerodynamics, you know, kept the ball rounder, forced the seams to stay lower. But that would have just gone down as a process improvement. Yeah, here we've improved the drying process. And by the way, improving the drying process ended up making a ball that traveled completely differently, but it doesn't count as a meaningful change because it's the sort of change that Rawlings makes all the time.
Is also not a word that has like a scientific definition.
Yeah,
like if they talked about something like a significant change.
Yeah.
Then, like, they're hinting at something that is actually defined. But if they just call it meaningful, then meaningful can be whatever they want it to mean, which is nothing.
And I mean, the issue, and this is actually one of the things I find a little strange with the postseason, was that there actually was a report put out in the New York Times, April 10th, I think, Joel Sherman had talked to MLB officials where they were doing their own internal drag testing for the 2019 ball. And, you know, this is, again, something that the home run committee insisted on because, of course, they found out, you know, drag's the big issue. And so, yeah, let's get the idea of Rawlings going in. Rawlings had never done drag testing before. You know, this was a novel concept. Again, I'm not going to get started as to why they never did it. Clearly, the home run committee was shocked too, but they did internal drag testing, at least, you know, before April 10th. We'll hope they did it earlier than opening day, considering that all of the baseballs for batch one were made before opening day. It seemed kind of weird to, if you were to say to do drag testing after you've already made, you know, hundreds of thousands of baseballs, but you know, whatever. They knew by the time that they did that interview or, you know, made that statement that the drag was lower on the 2019 ball. So, you know, MLB knew going into the regular season, there were going to be more home runs. They might not have known how many more, but their own internal testing told them lower drag means more home runs. You know, we figured that out. The home run committee figured that out. I'm a little surprised that there doesn't seem to be any, I don't know, record evidence. Nobody's come out and said anything, certainly not before the postseason. Because don't forget, remember, these were made in the first quarter of 2019. So these baseballs have been around presumably since, what, March?
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's been no reports of internal drag testing related to the postseason ball, which, you know, it would have been kind of nice, even if it was an anonymous official, the same way it was in that the article back in April, to say, oh, yeah, you know, the ball is behaving differently for the postseason. But that either they didn't do the testing or they didn't publicize the testing. But, you know, it would have been nice at least to tell the teams.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. You think.
So, yeah.
And I guess, yeah, so I mean, don't. Mm-hmm. A little bit, like, I guess in a sport where every ballpark is a different size, mm-hmm. you'd think that, like, we would be a little bit more comfortable with quirkiness and variation. And I guess as baseball fans, we are in a way. Mm-hmm. But obviously there are lines to be drawn in the sand wherever you want to draw them.
And like, in a kind of an oxymoronic way, you can have consistent inconsistency.
Yes.
If the balls were always weird, we wouldn't care about weird balls. Mm-hmm. That's a sentence I never thought I was going to say. So
there comes the first immature giggling of the segment.
Hello, listener. I'm Sean Ramos-Firm, host of Today Explained, Vox's daily news podcast. Every day, Monday through Friday, my team and I look at what's happening in the world. We pick one essential news story that defines our moment and ask smart people to help us understand it in about 20 minutes or less. It's the perfect way to start or end your day. Subscribe to Today Explained for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. It's from Stitcher and the Vox Media Podcast Network.
So kind of going back to our discussion about, like, you know, a crisis of faith in the game. So Meredith, I'm kind of mm-hmm. curious to hear your take on, like, between the baseballs and the cheating scandal and the minor leagues and everything that's been going on in the game from, like, a fan base perspective, that's kind of, you know, dampening the faith and the integrity of the game. Do you think that this is kind of an all-time low?
You left out Taubman.
Taubman and everything else. Yeah.
How could we forget about Taubman? Yeah.
Like we were kind of saying, chatting before the show, it's like any of these things would be a horrible, horrible scandal on its own. And now we have them all together. Like, do you think it's like an all-time low for, like, baseball, like, as far as, like, fan faith in the sport? Or, like, how does this compare to, like, the steroid era, for example, or, like, other eras of baseball where there's been, like, something that has compromised the integrity of the sport? Like, what do you think?
Well, one thing I will say that, let's put it this way. The reason, I mean, the steroid era was its own thing. What's the crisis of faith is absolutely there. And as much as anything, I think it's because so much is happening that I'm waking up every morning and expecting there to be another thing that's happened. You know, it's like, okay, so what's the scandal du jour? Mm-hmm. Because it almost has felt like, you know, someone was pointing out, yeah, we're already four scandals on from the postseason ball being different. And it was like November 21st.
Yeah.
It's like, we've been out of the postseason for 3 weeks and this is already where we are. What I think is a bigger deal than that, though, is that things like, for instance, the steroid stuff, and I would say that the sign stealing would sort of fit into this, but it being comparable to the steroid era, but not entirely, is that when we've had scandals before, they've tended to focus on the players. Yeah. And the players doing something wrong. In this case, you know, you go to Taubman, you go to, again, the sign stealing, which, you know, obviously players and coaches and stuff were involved, but there's enough tech in there where it becomes hard to, you know, the idea that only players and coaches were involved becomes a little difficult to justify.
And they've already seen the emails from the executive.
Exactly. So, you know, we know. And the idea that scouts were being, you know, so front office involvement was clearly an issue there. And then, you know, when you kind of keep going up the ranks to the whole minor league baseball thing, and that's MLB. And then there's the ball, which again is Rawlings and MLB. It gets very hard to make the players the focus of the scandals. I mean, you know, they're just not. It's the front offices. It's you know, it's the owners. It's the it's MLB itself. I mean, one of the things. And by the way, Allison, if you haven't read Allison's article, it's Baseball Prospectus, right?
Yeah,
rocks. Amazing, having to do with the minor league contraction stuff, and in particular the effect on communities. And I will freely say this is a big deal for me because I did all my graduate work in Montana, and the last thing I want to see is any cutback for the Pioneer League. So, you know, yes. Let's hear it for minor league baseball. The one of the things that I'm surprised hasn't gotten more press is that, you know, very early, I guess I shouldn't say early on, but, you know, when the owners' meetings were starting, say, one of the things that happened was that, what did they have, 104, 105 congresspeople?
Yeah.
Which is a quarter of Congress. We're, this is all the House. 435 reps for people who aren't necessarily, you know, don't have their numbers up for the House of Representatives. Came out and wrote a letter to, you know, an open letter to MLB saying, you know, by the way, we, you know, if you actually go into our communities and you know, take away our minor league teams, that this is not something we want and that the government has been supportive in the past. And, you know, we might want to have to think about that a little. It was that kind of language. I'm paraphrasing, but that was pretty much the way it was put.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, when candidates you get for president a quarter of Congress. Right. I mean, you know, it's and I got to read. This is just the most ridiculous. If you'll put up with this most ridiculous tweet that Ted Cruz put out.
Oh, God.
All people. That's why
this is so a
funny.
Weird game of Mad Libs.
No. You'll love it. So this gets because, yeah, Bernie Sanders came out and you know, had the same kind of thing that all of these congresspeople said, you know, that this is really bad. And there's a lot of reasons it's really bad. And I don't even understand. Certainly financially, I can't really justify it because it's not like it's going to save them a ton of money.
Nope.
So doesn't make any sense to me. But and this is
it's like
a couple
one mid-market
up.
Free agents worth of money per team,
something like that. Yeah. That's a good. I like that comparison. That's a good comparison, as opposed to just. I think somebody put out like less than 1/5 of 1% what their net profits are in a given year or something, which is
helps
just like
give it context.
Okay. Yeah, I mean it's so basically it's they're saving the change that you might find in the couch.
Yep.
Jeez. But yeah, so Ted Cruz's response, and this is I guess it's a response to Ben Shapiro, who has to come in and attack Sandy.
Oh my God.
Okay. So you go from Ben Shapiro to Ted Cruz. So, you know, and by the way, I don't mean to be, this is not about the politics so much as the reaction. Because Ted Cruz says, you know, referring to Ben Shapiro, says, "Ben, that's not nearly socialist enough. By government mandate, all pitchers must now pitch the average speed. We'll just redistribute miles per hour from fast pitchers to the slower pitchers, and no batter will be allowed to hit more than the league average." And I'm just like,
it's so great when you don't understand baseball or socialism.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I'm sorry. It's not entirely on topic, but I just thought, like, you know, my God, especially when you consider that here's a guy who, you know, if anything, shouldn't he, like, actually want this to go through because it's all capitalism or something? So yeah. I don't really get it. Yeah. You know, it's like, pick your sides. Anyway, but the idea being that this feels like it's spread a lot. Every team, you know, people, I know that Manfred has said it's just going to be the Astros, but this was 2017. There's been a lot of changes with front offices since then. There's, you know, or not even that, but with players, things like no team stays intact anymore at any level.
Yeah.
So players, like, for instance, that part of the reason this started is because Mike Fiers came out and said, he was with the A's now. Mm-hmm. Came out and said, yeah, we did this with the Astros in 2017. And he, you know, sort of was like the first one to go on the record by name and say this. And there's been a lot of changes since then of people who were with the Astros and aren't anymore at any number of levels.
Beltran being one of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the point being, though, that it's not going to be any one team. The odds of it, they're going to end up, regardless of how it works out, they're not going to be doing their due diligence if they don't end up investigating a lot of teams, because there's just too many other people who have gone to other teams. Mm-hmm. So that becomes sort of a crisis of faith, you know, not just for the fans, but there's a level of insecurity with any given team, because, you know, if MLB is doing this investigation and suddenly a lot of teams are going to get dragged into the investigation, and it's all going to be finger pointing. I mean, if you already start with an A's pitcher finger pointing at the Astros, you know, everybody, you know, how long before the melee starts, right?
Yeah.
And then you have the minor league cuts, which I'm not really sure. Again, I don't entirely understand the motivation behind it, because it doesn't feel like it would cost them that much to not continue the system. I mean, you know, I've heard minor arguments from people that it's more, you know, but again, nothing that sort of seems to pan out as far as the kind of benefits that MLB and the owners normally go for.
Yeah.
And instead, they're just ending up with people in Congress threatening their you know, potential economic status within the you know, just within the country. You know, I mean, I've you know, I think Bernie Sanders specifically said antitrust exemption.
Yep.
But, you know, the Congress people were a little more subtle than that.
Yeah.
But so it's like the fact that all of this has started all at once, and I'm trying to figure out how things could be being played more badly than they are. You know, it's like, you know, here's a shovel, keep digging, is kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, like dig up,
stupid.
Well, yep. My fear is, you know, they're, like we were saying, you know, a lot of fans are losing faith, and you know, like we said, it's like this rolling ocean of scandals, like wave after wave, and there's a lot of animosity between the players and the owners right now. So it seems it's not a given, but there's,
which the commissioner didn't help with, by the way.
Yes,
I mean, like, he came out with a very, very firm statement saying, basically, I think he said no economic concessions.
Yes, it's exactly what he said.
But it was just like, really? Do you really want to pick this battle right this now? Too, you know, don't you have enough on your plate?
So it seems like we might have a strike or a lockout or
might strike.
Might. Yes.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I'm holding out.
I was going to say that's really optimistic of you. I'd say it's more an over under on when it starts.
But yeah. Then where does baseball go from that? Because if people already are losing faith in the sport, like, will that just be the capper?
Oh, God, this is killing me.
I've had some interesting discussions with people about this. And ultimately, it kind of comes down to, first of all, you know, in something like that, there's always a bad guy, as it were. Yeah. And when there's, you know, I hate to say it. I actually remember the 94-95 strike. I have a number of friends who don't, but I remember when it happened.
I remember.
And, yeah, I know. The point is that, like, I have colleagues who just, they were far too young to have any memory of this. So it's like, mm-hmm. It's all right.
Babies.
But they're actually very well-qualified baseball people. They of just course. Happen to be, you know, young enough to not remember the strike. But in that case, you know, it was, and I believe when it's happened before, the players are the bad guys. And it's easy to do that because, of course, the players are depriving us of baseball. Like I was just saying, though, it's a little harder to come up with the players as the source of all the problems, or, you know, almost any of the problems, actually. And so I'm not really sure what the response would be from fans. You know, I can absolutely see, like, let's put it this way. If there is a strike, I'm on the player's side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just becomes a question of how, I almost feel like it's going to be something that's probably going to require that the players think it through, because they shouldn't be being vilified. They're not responsible for any of the stuff that's been the major stuff that's been going on. And the only way that they're going to end up being the bad guys is if people start getting on that bandwagon of, okay, yeah, the contract that you're asking for is some number that is larger than the context that I'm thinking in. You know, so it's like, what do you mean you're asking for $120 million for something without taking into account that actually, according to what he should be paid, it should be, like, you know, 180. And by the way, these owners are worth, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So that's not really a big deal. Particularly, I mean, if they're bringing in, you know, $10 to $11 billion a year in net profits, that's a, you know, they can afford the extra $50 million. So, like, the numbers, I think, can be a problem if the context isn't there.
Yeah.
And that they just, you know, have to make people aware of the fact that they're, you know, it's not just about the contracts. It's about the fact that, for instance, nobody knows what the 2020 ball is going to be like. Mm-hmm. I guess I also have to wonder, even at this point, even the front offices aren't happy about stuff. I have no idea where front offices come down in strikes. Yeah. I literally don't. But they're, you know, I guess I'm trying to figure out who would be happy with what's going on right now. Anybody?
Ownership?
Maybe. You know, although, even at that point, I mean, is there a tipping point where, you know, if your fans are so disillusioned that they're going to just drop your sport entirely, if you decide you're going to cut off such a large percentage of the fan base, you know, and Allison, I think you pointed this out in your article, is that, like, most of the areas, say in the Pioneer League, are, you know, they're already blacked out for a whole bunch of, like, for at least one major league team anyway. So it's not like they can even watch the major league team that's, like, you know, 500 miles away.
Teams in Montana, the towns in Montana that have these teams that are being contracted, are blacked out of the Seattle Mariners 800 miles away.
Exactly. And it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. Absurd. So it's like, you know, all right, you're doing your best to alienate the fan base as much as possible. And I get, you know, the TV contracts thing and the fact that as long as those TV contracts exist, it doesn't matter if they have fans or not, because they're like bundled with other things. So if you're a football fan, you buy the TV package, you know, the baseball channel gets picked up too. They get the money too. That's how it works. But even those TV contracts won't last forever. And if you've already alienated all your fans and the TV contracts go away, then what happens?
Yeah.
Or let's say okay, long shot. The little holographic stickers on the hats, for instance, merchandise. So let's say that the fact that, you know, all those baseballs that were being sold by Rawlings with the authentication stickers saying that they're game balls, and people realize, okay, I've bought this authenticated thing that I've been told is a game ball that turns out isn't. Does that have a ripple effect into like, okay, maybe this hat that I'm buying isn't a real authenticated hat either?
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like there's a lot of potential repercussions that I'm not really sure. Even my point being, I think even the owners need to rethink some of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And when it comes like, and going back to like the players, like who ends up coming down as the bad guy in the end, and the players being seen as the bad guy, I think that like at least, and it's easy to be in our like bubbles and our silos, like as like baseball nerds and people who write about baseball and talk about baseball all the time. But I do think that there is a groundswell of like support for the players this time around. But on the other side of the same coin, like a lot of these actions being taken by front offices and by baseball itself, like the contracting of minor league teams, reducing access to, you know, players who people might connect with as people, because they aren't the millionaires, right? Those players are minor league players that don't make any money. So those are players that you can like relate to more on a human level and aren't putting on this high pedestal of, oh, you're a millionaire, I can't relate to. And front offices constantly championing efficiency over human elements of the game, I feel like makes it almost easier to commodify and dehumanize these players and, you know, demonize them in these sorts of fights.
Yeah. I mean, I guess let's put it this way. There's going to be a strike. I just want it to do some good. I want it to mean something.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff. And like, you know, of course, the minor leagues will end up with a problem because, you know, the collective bargaining agreement, which is ultimately what the strikes, at least the timing of the strikes relates to that. I have a feeling this collective bargaining agreement may be a little more nuanced than some of them have been in the past. At the very least, I sincerely hope that they look into getting involved in oversight for the baseball. Because right now, every single piece of equipment that ends up on the field has to be approved by the rules committee, except the baseball.
Oh.
Yep. It's in the official rules, actually. So like, if you have a two-tone bat, if your bat is more than one color, you literally have to get it approved by the rules committee. Anything that isn't like sort of strictly to whatever spec has to be approved. And yet for some reason, there isn't a comparable rule for the ball. And it seems like that might not be a bad idea. And that would be an obvious thing for the collective bargaining agreement. But the minor leagues, unfortunately, never do well in those either because of the people doing the negotiation. So I don't know if that's going to change or not. I'd like to see it change. Yeah. But, you know, at the very least, it's nice to see minor league communities that have minor league teams really, you know, fighting for keeping them, and giving context, you know, that these aren't just like, these teams don't necessarily, it's not like they necessarily came into existence because like poof, MLB needed a place to put their minor leaguers. You know, right, a lot of the teams actually have histories that are far, far what's it, the Chattanooga Lookouts, I think, have existed in some form since the 1880s.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. You know,
they're the oldest
sorry,
minor league team, and they're gone. They're going to be gone now.
Right. And it's just, why? You know, it's, I feel like there's got to be better solutions. You know, if for whatever reason that team doesn't want, you know, that affiliate there, then it doesn't mean you have to kill the team.
Teams change their affiliates all the time. Like that's,
oh God, yes.
That's just a normal part of running an organization. And yeah, and it doesn't mean that you have to kill the team.
Yeah, I mean, I will admit, like, for instance, the Colorado Springs team, it seems a little bit like a hot potato, actually.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of, if you follow, like, which teams have had that as an affiliate in the last 10 years or so, it's almost like, okay, I really hope the music doesn't stop while that, you know, while we have Colorado Springs as our affiliate, mostly because it's at, like, 7,500 feet, and minor leaguers I know who played there, it's not their favorite park to play in, you know, so that's one that's going to be a little, you know, that becomes one that's tough to justify, but you know, I'm sure people in Colorado Springs would miss it. I want whatever happens, it would be nice to know what the ball is going to do, or at least know enough to know what to expect roughly going into the next season. It would be nice to, you know, have better, you know, ground rules as far as, you know, let's figure out the sign stealing stuff. Let's figure out the, you know, having basically comes, a lot of it comes down to players being treated fairly and having information. And, you know, can we also not kill baseball for a huge portion of the country? You know, it's like, we don't have to break it all.
We don't have to break it all.
That would be nice.
Yeah.
I think breaking it all is a good way to transition to Maggie's happier question.
I have an important question, and this is very relevant to the fairly significant contingent of baseball crafters out there. And I just have to know what you're working on right now, if there's anything baseball related or, you know, holiday gifts coming up. What do you have on the needles?
Right now, of course, and of course, you know, I've been doing this. I've been knitting through the entire time we're talking, because that's just what I do. it's this one's just a sock. I have any number of things on needles right now. In fact, I need to hurry up, and that the Ty Cobb sweater is so close to finished, and I need to just finish it. So that's the baseball related thing, I guess. And as far as holidays, I have what I mean, most people might think it's a downer. I tend to think it's pretty enlightened. Our family just doesn't give gifts at holidays.
Hey, whatever works.
Yeah, it doesn't mean we don't give gifts. It just means that, like, you know, if you find something that's like perfect for somebody, then you get it for them regardless of the time of year. And that way you don't get stuck with like token gifts. So I've been known to give gifts around holidays, but it doesn't necessarily mean because it's a holiday. So that means, you know, if people choose not to send me Christmas gifts, I won't necessarily be offended because I won't send them anything. So, but you know, if they want to, they
can.
Seems
fair. Hey.
Yeah. So.
All's fair in love and Christmas shopping.
Excited to see that final Ty Cobb sweater.
Oh, it's so close. It's, I'm literally like getting the plaque. So it's basically what technical terms. The plaque is basically done. I'm just in the process of stitching, like whip stitching it on. I need to finish the buttonholes, and then I need to actually do the logo. And I think that's it. Oh, and sew the buttons on, obviously.
Yeah. I just finished a sweater for my husband that was sitting untouched for 6 months because I really hated the way I did a tubular bind off on a 2x1 ribbing, and I just needed to redo it. That's all I needed to do. And so it sat there for 6 months, but finished it like yesterday. He wore it today.
Aww.
This you'll appreciate. I finished the sweater earlier this year, a couple months ago. When did I start it? 2011, 2012?
That's amazing. Moths have prevented me from being able to do that.
I actually have, I mean, if you ask me projects that are on needles or you know, works in progress that are on hold, I literally do go back and finish projects that are old enough where I'm kind of embarrassed to admit how old they are. but yeah, so I mean, yeah, that one, it was, you know, 7 or 8 years in the making, but it's well, it's a gorgeous sweater. I mean, I'm really glad I finished it. It's really nice.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
So we are going to take one more break, and when we get back, we are going to do, like we do every week, walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week, baseball-related or otherwise, so stay tuned for that. And we are back. So, like we always do, we're going to do walk-off wins. So, Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Well, this is Thanksgiving week, and Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. But specifically what made me really happy this week was my son's school. And, you know, he's in kindergarten, so it's our first year with the school. It turns out one of their like regular things that they do every year is they get all the classes together, and it's like a little potluck that parents and lots of different classes will contribute to. And it was just like they did a little like song and dance of Thanksgiving songs. There are apparently many Thanksgiving songs. I didn't know. They're not good, but the kids are adorable and that's all that matters. And it's only kindergarten, so I didn't have to sit through other people's kids, which is great.
That's the best part, right?
It was really great. But it was just for like a way to kick off my favorite holiday. It was so sweet and earnest, and the teachers were so into it, and everybody really just came together. And like, also I just had a massive, massive quantity of food. And I think there is still a brownie in my coat pocket that I just remembered, and I should get that before the cat does. But yeah, so that's my walk-off win was Tommy's kindergarten Thanksgiving party.
Beautiful. Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
Mine is kind of similar that it's Thanksgiving related. But we have a therapy dog come into work for our Read to Rover program, and he is going to be in the dog show on Thanksgiving.
Heck yes!
Oh my gosh, the Westminster dog show?
It's not the one. He's going to be in Westminster, but this is the one in Philadelphia, I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so this is like a real serious dog show?
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
Spoilers. I won't say, but look for Drew. And he's a Belgian Tavern. He's big. He's fluffy. He's so soft. He's got little pointy ears.
I
think he's either in the sporting group or the working group. I can't remember which one is which. But yeah, so I was talking to Patty, his owner, and she's like, yeah, this is like my pet. And she was like, and everybody else there is getting paid like serious money to show their dogs. And I asked her if she saw Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir. She said they were there, but she did not see them, which was very heartbreaking to me because I really want to know what they're like in person. But yeah, so look for our wonderful Drew. He also goes to, since he is a therapy dog, he also goes to a local children's hospital, and the kids there have kind of seen him growing up because she's been bringing him since he was a puppy at 8 weeks old. So he might be featured because of his work that he does. We're not sure. The producers could cut it. But yeah, so we're very happy that we have a star as our Read to Rover dog.
That's Yay. So cute.
That's awesome.
We love Drew.
I will be I hope that I can finagle watching the dog show instead of football, but I think I might be outvoted in that regard.
You should come to my house. We only watch the dog show at my house. And dog show and Miracle on 34th Street. Bam, bam, bam.
Beautiful. So my walk-off win for this week is not Thanksgiving related, but we are hosting Thanksgiving at my house for the first time this year. So we'll see how that goes. I'm going to be doing some of the cooking. So eek, we'll see. So that's happy. But my walk-off
the turkey's thawed.
Yep. It's okay, it's ready to go. And so my walk-off win is that last weekend I went back to Baltimore for my friend's birthday, and it was the first time I had been back in Baltimore since August. And I moved, for those of you who don't remember or know, I lived in Baltimore for 6 years for grad school, and then I moved back to New Jersey for this year to do my fellowship. And so I've been missing Baltimore a heck of a lot. I had really come to call it home during my 6 years there. And so going months and months at a time without being there was sad, especially without seeing my dog. And so I finally got to spend a weekend in Baltimore because it was my friend's birthday. So we went down there. We went to all the Baltimore breweries that I had missed so much. And I got to see my puppy. So I'm really happy.
Cricket.
I missed my puppy so much. And I got to love her. And Michael got to meet her for the first time, so I don't have to dump him because she liked
in
him.
In other words, Cricket, I was going to say Cricket liked Mike. That's the way it's got to work, right?
Exactly.
That's
important. He was like,
love me, love my dog type thing. Yeah.
Exactly. He was like, meeting your parents, you know, that's one thing. Meeting your friends, whatever. But Cricket, that's the true test. And I think he appropriately bribed her with toys. So I think that he's in the trust circle now. So that means I don't have to get rid of him. So that's good. So yeah, it was a great weekend. Michael hadn't been in Baltimore since like middle school, I think he said. So I got to show him a city that I spent so much of my time in. So that was nice. It was just a nice weekend being back in my old stomping grounds. It was happy. So that's my walk-off
great.
Win.
Love it.
Dr. Meredith Wills, what is your walk-off win?
Well, mine is going to sound really minor because it's actually sort of relating to just the conversation that we've had. In the entire time we've talked, I only heard the cats break one thing in the other room. And in my mind, that is definitely a walk-off win.
Hell yeah. That's a victory.
Good job, kitties.
Yay.
Yay,
I might have been doing it quietly, so I may go in there and discover there's more, but I only heard one loud smash.
Yeah, that's great. So that does it for the show this week. Thank you so much, Dr. Wells, for coming on again. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. You guys are always, by the way, I should finish by saying that the podcast I did with you before, hands down my dad's favorite.
Yes.
Like, aww. He refers to it all the time.
We passed the dad test.
He's going to be ecstatic that I've talked to you guys again.
Yes.
Now that we've had you on twice, we get to officially call you friend of the show, right?
Yeah.
Like that.
Oh, I hope so.
That's. Oh, I mean, I've kind of been calling you that already, but like, I feel like now it's
official.
Official. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So for those of you who haven't read it yet, you should absolutely read Dr. Wills' article on The Athletic along with Katie Strang's accompanying article on this whole process that we just spent the last hour or so talking about. Get more details on that. Read those articles in The Athletic. In the meantime, Meredith, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, basically Twitter is the place to look, and I have a painful handle, which is short for baseball astrophysics, BBL_ and then astrophysics without the I, because that was just the character limit back when I made the handle. I know someone's going to want to say something about my Etsy shop, and it does exist, but I'm not going to go into too much detail because since I've been doing all the baseball research, I can't do anything with the covers until we know what's going on with the baseball.
Right.
So it's kind of been on hiatus. I should just put it on vacation. But yeah, so Twitter is a lot of fun. And, you know, I think I tweet interesting stuff. I just retweet a lot of Allison stuff, and that seems to work.
And I always appreciate getting the coveted retweet. So yes, you can find Dr. Meredith Wills on Twitter. Follow her on Twitter. You can find the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can find each of us on Twitter. I am at Petite PhD. Where are you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
And you, Linda?
At Linda Servage.
So follow all of us on Twitter. Follow the show on Twitter. Follow Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. We are covering all of the Mets coaching staff hires and all of the various reaction to that. Linda has an article coming out soon about what we're thankful for this year and ahead of Thanksgiving. It'll be a really good article. It features like a lot of the staff and what we are thankful for this year, Mets related. So that's coming. All of our free agent profiles are going to start hitting hitting soon, so look out for that. So yeah, look for all of our content at Amazing Avenue. The intro and outro to this show is by Bunga, and you can subscribe to the podcast. Please do that on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts from. So please rate and review the show. It really helps people find it. Let's go Mets, and don't forget, there is no crying in podcasting.